All the words that we chant, the clothes that we wear, and all of the ideas that we have about practice are not practice. These are only the tools that can support us in waking up to the heart of the teaching. The teaching doesn't exist in the books. It doesn't exist in the words. It doesn't exist in the places. But it doesn't exist other than in those things. If we want to know the heart of the teaching, then we must wake up to the roots of war and violence in us. I never call myself a vegetarian. Never. Well, I should never say never. Rarely. People often refer to me as a vegetarian. But really what I look at, I simply say I don't eat meat, fish, or poultry. And I don't eat dairy products. It's about the first precept. Don't kill. It was a way for me to work consciously with that topic because I am a murderer. And when I mean that, literally, I've killed people. And I've killed people with guns and knives. I've killed people with my hands. And I live with the consequences of those acts every moment of every day of my life. They do not haunt me in the ways in which they did, because through the container of this discipline, spiritual practice that's been passed on to me for 82 generations, I have found my way, or I should say acceptance has found me. When talking about Buddhist practice, and when talking about Buddhist teachings, I find it incredibly important to be able to articulate these teachings with a language that can be easily understood by anyone. And I seldom use Dharma-specific terms, because when I'm in the middle of Kamina 13 in Medellin, and I'm talking to gangbangers who are cranked out on inhalants, and I start talking about Bodhi and Buddha nature, and I start talking about all of that, and they just want to shoot me, you know. They don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But I can talk about all of those things in a language that's accessible to them. And I think what I've known, even before I came to Buddhist practice, is the importance of that. Now, I've read my way through 82 volumes of the Pali Canon and reread some of those very valuable texts. That I don't read them with the intention to memorize them. I don't read them with the intention that by reciting something, chapter and verse, I can suddenly I can use that as an identity. When I read through a section of teaching, most of it doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense. I'm going, you know, for 10,000 aeons and 15 million grains of sand in the Ganges River that exist in the eastern budget, and I'm just going, man, what's this? It doesn't make any sense to me, but I read it anyway. And I'm glad that it doesn't make any sense to me in a literal way. Because as I read my way through, whatever's contained in the translations of the original spoken words, because I just have to take it, I take it at face value, that these words that are written down are literations of the original spoken word. I still find it pretty hard to believe, you know, that these are the exact teachings that have been passed on verbatim for 450 years before somebody wrote them down. I go, get out of here. Come on. You know. Okay, so it's possible. But in the end, it's not worth arguing or debating. This is what I have. This is what I study. Now, well, it was, and part of the introduction was that I've made an effort, I made a decision when I was invited to become ordained to practice in, to engage in this path in a more traditional way, or in a traditional way. In the, I learned that in the mid-19th century, somewhere between 1860 and 1865, there were civil laws enacted in Japan that enabled monks to grow their hair, get married, they could eat meat. And there are two streams of thought regarding the enacting of those laws. One was that it opened Buddhist traditions up and so it enabled more people to come into them. And the other was that they were intended to subvert, corrupt, and ultimately destroy Buddhist practice. Now, the foundation for this thinking developed when there was a dynastic change in the 18th century. So we entered into when they entered into the Meiji period. Prior to the Meiji period, Buddhism was the state religion in Japan. But entering into the Meiji period, that changed because that dynastic family had more, what they felt was more wholesome and national interest. They were right-wing nationalists. And so they adopted Shintoism as the state religion, seeing that was, that wasn't indigenous to Japan, but nonetheless they thought it was, so they enacted it. Once they enacted Shintoism, Buddhism fell out of favor, lost access to the court, lost access to the grant money, the imperial coffers, and monks started to leave the temples. The temples started to fall into disrepair, and those monks who ran around in all those flashy robes didn't have access to the emperor anymore. They didn't have any influence anymore. And so, it was out of that series of events that these laws were enacted. I'm not interested ever to get into debate with people about whether they were meant to corrupt or whether they weren't, or whether they've had a corrupting effect or not. It's not the point for me. The point for me was that if this was good for 2,400 years up to that point, then I want experience. If I'm going to make, I've never been able to do anything sort of half measure. If I'm going to do this thing, I want to do it. And so I spoke with my preceptor and asked him if it would be all right, and he said, yes, but you're going to have to do the research, you're going to have to pull together the vows, and then we'll do it. He said, when it comes to the monastic rules, the Vinaya, he said, I can't help you. He said, you're going to have to find someone who can support you. And I was okay with that. You know, and I didn't have someone right away. I have a copy of the Vinaya that it's about this big, a little book like this. I have two of them, and it's so small that I have to use it. Sometimes I have to get the thing out to read it. But I read my way through the Vinaya, and then I was invited to a conference on Buddhism in Singapore, and I was hosted at the largest Buddhist monastery on the island, and I was befriended by an elder Indian man who was ordained in the Sri Lankan Theravadan tradition. His name's Dhammavihari. Every morning I would get up and I would go and knock on his door and wake him up. And I would accompany him on his morning walks. He was thinking this late 70s, early 80s at that time. And then I would go to the breakfast line with him, and I would prepare his tray, and I would serve him. And he was just the most wonderful thing to do. And I asked him if he would, I explained to him my circumstance. I asked him if he would guide me in relation to the Vinaya, and he said, sure, as long as you remember that you are a Western Buddhist monk ordained in a Zen tradition, and that this is the 20th century. And I said, well, okay. I didn't have any idea what it meant, but I said, okay, sure. And so we engage in a process. This is a man who he lived a lay life. His Mary had kids, and he taught Buddhism in universities in India, in Canada. He'd started a couple programs in other universities, and when his family was settled, his children are gone. Everything was set up so that his family would be cared for. He just one day just up and walked out the door. No note, no message or anything. Such a very traditional way of home leaving. And what great respect I had for him. Courage to do that. What great courage it took for him to do that. And I asked him, I said, if he'd had any contact with his family at all? He said, no. He said, that was another life. Immediately I understood the whole notion of reincarnation. I had a grasp of it that I never had before. So my relationship with him, he died a year and a half ago. My relationship with him was very dear and special to me, very insightful to me, and very helpful. Also very empowering because of the life that I live. I'm not a monastery monk. I've trained in monasteries, I've lived in monasteries, and as I mentioned, they're some of the unhealthiest places I've ever lived. Although my time there was important, I think it's incredibly important for me to know the It's very important for me to know how to set up a monastery. It's very important for me to know how to conduct a service. It's very important for me to know how to wear my robes in this very formal institutional sense. It's very important for me to know how to communicate with the bells, and it's very important for me to know how to conduct various ceremonies. It's very important. It was very important for me to go through certain empowerment rituals. Out of respect for the teachings that have been passed down to me through 82 generations, what becomes incredibly important for me is not that I just become a lineage replicator. I don't see that as being faithful to the teachings that were passed on to me. That I know these things, but that I allow them to manifest themselves through me as they will. I'm not into changing things, but to manifest themselves in me as they will. I was ordained in Auschwitz at the site of one of the crematoriums. To prepare for that ordination, I sat in the selection site. I don't know if people have, if any of you have been to Auschwitz or been to Birkenau. Birkenau is often referred to as Auschwitz, but it's not the Auschwitz camp. Birkenau was built about 2 or 3 kilometers away from the Auschwitz main camp. And it was built to house, 2,600, 3,000 people. They had many more than that in there, and they were used as slave labor to work in the factories that were about 5 or 6 kilometers down the road. People there were used for medical experiments. They were used in the most horrendous of ways. They were used in the most horrendous of ways because they were dehumanized. I understand that dehumanization because that's part and parcel of how we are affected by the collective conscious of which we are a part. It's very important to look at how we are conditioned, the karma that we inherit through family lineages and through through this collective conscious. It's very important to see how as a Caucasian male in the society and culture, I'm conditioned to view the world. This is conditioning that I had no choice over. I was infused with it. I'm conditioned to see women as sexual objects. I'm conditioned to see women as inferior, as less than. And I'm not different from any other man in the society and culture. And if I just go and say, well, I'm not like that, I don't want to be like that, then I'm living in ignorance. And the very, very essence of my conditioning will continue to drive me in ways that are unseen. They'll have me joining the military. They'll have me dehumanizing a whole race of people. And they'll have me seeing those people as the enemy and the source of all my problems. And they'll give me permission to kill them, to abuse them, to do what I want with them. In Auschwitz, in Birkenau, the camp is structured with a brick facade in the front, with 2 gates in the center. And the facade had guards and had offices. And the train would enter in through the gates, and then the tracks divided into two. In the center was the area called the selection site. And what would happen is an SS officer with a small wooden table and a ledger book would situate himself outside of one of the cattle cars in which people were transported in. And then as camp guards would take people off these trains, he would get their names, have a look at them, and decide on the spot if they went immediately to their deaths or if they were going to be sentenced to slave labor with the intention that they would die. Because they had to die. They had to die because there were so many people coming into the camps. There wasn't enough space for them. So it was a process of attrition. So many people had to die to create space for the new people coming in. It's a business. I sat in the selection site in preparation to become ordained, fasting. No food, no water for 4 days. Fasting and chanting. And what was very important to me through this process, my eyes kept going to the guard towers. Because we still create this separation of victim and perpetrator. And seeing these two categories as mutually exclusive. For example, when Auschwitz was liberated, the prisoners in the camp immediately took the camp commander hostage and hung him. Now, they believed they were entitled to do that because they were victimized by this person. And as a victim, I'm entitled. But what happens the moment you hang him, you become the perpetrator. within me exists all things. I have to be very cautious when I get caught up into the idea of redemptive violence. Violence is never a solution, ever. War is not an effective form of conflict resolution at whatever level that manifests itself. The whole point of awakening, and that, well, that is the point of, that is the point of what we do here, is to wake up. Wake up, I use that as a euphemism for Satori or Kensho or enlightenment. And I don't like to use those words because they have too many connotations attached to them. To wake up. That awakening isn't so much a transcendent I'm not telling you this on, I'm not sharing this with you based on personal information. This is what people tell me. That it's not a transcendent experience, but it's a unifying experience. And this is something I understand. See, I kept looking at the guard towers because I am a perpetrator. But I also looked at the barriers because I am also a victim. If you look at every perpetrator has also been a victim. If we want the world to be different, if we want to wake up, what are we willing to do? Are we willing to see in us both victim and perpetrator? Or do we want to continue to create separation endlessly, self and other? I don't have any enemies today. Well, let's say I don't have any enemies right now. I haven't driven back to Oakland. I don't know, I haven't gone over the bridge. I don't know, you know. At any moment, I'm vulnerable. That's why it's so critical. The discipline, to have a disciplined spiritual practice is so critical. Not the idea of it, but the actuality of it. Every moment of every day has to be a reflection of that 40 minutes that we spent here in silence. How does sitting meditation blossom? How does it grow into everything that we do all of the time? Not an exercise. I knew that by the time I was 10. I want the world to be different. I have no idea what that means, but I want it to be different. And I know that we can bring an end to war. We can bring an end to war by waking up to the roots of war in us, not blaming the government or trying to change them, because that's not the problem. The issue is here. It's here. To bring it back always to self, to self, to self. Rooted in discipline, spiritual practice, see what happens next. Today I was sitting on the green in Berkeley, in front of the university. And I sit with my friend Daniel Dolan. Daniel's been sitting there for once a week for 10 years. As an active statement about the senselessness of war. So I'm sitting there, right? And it's a step for me. Yeah. I'm sitting there and I'm breathing and following my breath. I'm concentrating. Just like concentrate on the precise point where the breath enters my body. I don't follow the breath into the body. I concentrate on that precise point. And then when I breathe out, I concentrate on the precise point where my breath leaves the body. I do that because that's how I was taught. In this lineage, that's what I was taught. So I do that. I don't argue, I just do it. And see what rises out of that doing. And I'm sitting there, and suddenly I can see a handgun pointed right at my head. Yeah. I can see the finger pull the trigger, I can hear the hammer hit that round, and I can feel my skin burn as that round hits me in the face. I can smell the gunpowder. Life is like that. Any given moment, it's that fragile. Every night I sit and I do service. I have a formal practice that I do. And at the conclusion of that practice, I do a recitation. Sometimes I call it the, sometimes we call it the life and death verse, and sometimes we call it the evening gatha. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time passes swiftly by and opportunities are lost. Each of us must strive to awaken. Awaken. Take heed. Do not squander this life. Precious opportunity I have to be existent in this form, because it is in this form that I have the possibility to put myself in a position where my where the suffering, which is the karma I have inherited through past generations in the collective conscious, can become transformed. So for all of the harm that I've ever caused you, through my thought, speech, and action, I apologize to you. And I make a commitment to you to never do those things again. For all of the harm that I've ever caused you, through my thoughts, speech, and action, I apologize to you. And I make the commitment to never do those things again. For all of the harm that I have ever caused you, through my thoughts, speech, and action, I apologize to you. And I make the commitment to never do those things again. Now that doesn't mean that I'm still not affected, that I am immune from my conditioning. I am not. But because I'm open to that, when it surfaces, I don't have to pretend that it's something that it's not. And practice of meditation. Stopping. Coming back to the breath. Allowing myself to settle. And it's through that process that transformation takes place. I'm, as a man, I'm in the society, I'm conditioned to be an object of violence. I'm offered up on the sacrificial altar. Visit the emergency rooms. Look at the statistics amongst those coming in who are broken and battered between the ages of 3 and 11. You're going to see the majority of them are young boys, almost exclusively. If I want the world to be different, it can be if I'm willing to wake up. I'm conditioned to see men as my competition. I'm conditioned to have to put myself in a dominant position to be superior at all costs. I want my life to be different. I need to be conscious of that and put myself in a position where transformation is and healing is possible. It doesn't mean that that conditioning goes away. It just means my relationship to it begins to change. And I'm often not even aware that it's changing. I am a soldier. I will never not be a soldier. I don't have to create a world out of ignorance to defend actions that are indefensible. Acceptance. See, understanding, acceptance, responsibility, and action. Sit just to sit, eat just to eat, walk just to walk. Be conscious of all of my ideas of things and be willing to let them float away on the next out-breath. I'll open it up for any question you might have, but I want to put a frame around this. You can ask me any question you want. Absolutely nothing is out of bounds. Providing it's a question. You have, this is a dedicated community. So 6 words or less. Yeah. If you need 7 or 8, I'm feeling generous tonight. But really, if you have a question, please ask it directly and to the point. It doesn't need a lot of lead up and a big story to explain your questions. Just ask direction to the point. If you disagree with anything I've said, I'm not interested to debate about that matter. You're already right. Question. Name?
Carl,
ask me. The 6 words.
Won't make the 6 words. You said conditioning doesn't change, but your relationship to it does change. And I was wondering if you could expand or say a little bit more about that. Yeah.
I am of the nature to create enemies. I am of the nature to see external issues and external sources or external entities or experiences as a source of my suffering. I am conditioned to understand that if I just eliminate that, then my suffering will go away. I am of the nature to think and act like that. That process never ends. But my relationship to the process can end if I'm aware that the process exists. If I let go of all of my ideas of things, then I have the sense, I have the experience then, that if I don't reject this, the nature of my conditioning, or if I don't let it define me, but learn to just hold it, to be present with it. And it's like the thought processes that the thought spaces we pass through as we sit in silence. They come into existence and they pass away. So it's learning how to not reject or not be identified by, how to just be present. And it's impossible for this to happen unless I want it to happen. If I don't want it to happen, it's never going to happen. Question? Ask me.
How much time passed between
name.
Augusta. How much time passed?
Georgia. Is your last name Georgia?
Hopkins.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Between ordination and meeting your teacher.
Say again.
How much time passed between the ordination that you described and meeting the teacher that you described?
Well, I mean, I was ordained by my teacher. My teacher just couldn't support me through the Vinaya.
Yes.
Because he didn't live like that. You see, I'm ordained in a tradition where we go into this really dedicated practice period. Rohatsu. That's what's happening now. And, you know, you're very formal and very... And you sit and you don't talk and you don't look and you eat, you don't eat meat, fish or poultry, you know, and you don't take any intoxicants, and at the end of the Rahatsu session they have a party and they smoke cigars, eat burgers and drink beers. And I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to live in a different way. Because it just so the person that I met who ordained me, my teacher, I refer to him as my preceptor. Okay. I met him in Yonkers, New York. You smile. Where are you from?
Brooklyn.
Oh yeah. Okay. I met him in Yonkers, and he showed me all the bells and whistles of his monastery. And then I left and went. I was living in Concord, Massachusetts at the time. I went back to Concord. As I was there like 2 or 3 days, I called him up and I said, okay, so I've seen all the bells and whistles, now I want to talk to you. And this was some years back, and I was much less refined, a little more edgy. We set up an appointment, I went down, and when I'm anxious, one of the ways in which one of my coping mechanisms around anxiety is I would talk too much, talk fast. And so I was sitting in the office and I was, and he said, whoa, let's just sit together for a few minutes. And so I said, okay. So we were sitting together and I'm doing my thing and being all holy. And we finished sitting. He looked at me and said, I want to ordain you. Bang! Just like that. I went, ordain me? What are you talking about? You don't even know me. He said, I know you enough. And then I went through a period of study, and then he came to Auschwitz. I was the vehicle that got him there. He is by birth Jewish.
Are you by birth Jewish?
No. He is by birth Jewish, and he lost family in Auschwitz. Distant family, but nonetheless lost family, and he'd never been. Wanted to go and couldn't get there. I became the instrument to help him get there. The ordination. So I was ordained there. Now, between that ordination, that my novice ordination, and finding the Vinaya teacher, I don't know. It is quite some years. And I didn't mean I didn't have conversations with people about it, but until I met Dhamma Vihari, it was quite some years. So I was just doing this in a way that made sense. Then Dhamma Vihara then became a person I could check what I thought was sense, making sense. I could check with him. Question?
Well, you answered half of it.
Okay.
How come you chose Auschwitz to get ordained?
That's what my preceptor, made that choice.
It was his choice.
Yes. He made that choice. I was already committed to do a pilgrimage from Auschwitz to Hiroshima. Uh-huh. And I already made that commitment. Uh-huh. And he made the choice. Actually, he wanted to come, and he wanted to give me my formal monk's ordination in Vietnam. He wanted to come there and do it, but then his teacher died. He got drunk, passed out in a hot tub and drowned.
Who was that?
My Zimmer Motion.
It's a good reason to keep the 5 precepts.
I want to be cautious about this. Because it's easy to start creating separation. I don't want to be judgmental about this. And there's teaching in there for me. You know, I have no judgment on the merit of what happened to these people. I can, their example demonstrates to me what I don't want to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I want to be conscious not to be insensitive. I'm sorry that he died. Just as I'm intensely moved and sorry for all the people I've ever been responsible for killing. And they're in the hundreds. I was a helicopter crew chief. I was a door gunner. I could see the people I was responsible for killing. She's not. You finished?
I defer to her. Thank you.
Tell me.
Lynn.
Elaine.
Lynn.
Lynn.
Mm-hmm. Is there any use in my speaking to my brother who's followed my father's footsteps in being a military officer about his conduct?
Well, it depends on what you want to talk to him about. Yeah. If you're trying to, if you want to talk to him to convince him of the rightness of your position and the wrongness of his position, then you can't engage with him. Mm-hmm. You need to be, I need, when I talk with people like this, I need to be willing to put myself in their skin so that I can engage with them from a place of, from as strong a place of non-judgment as possible. The most powerful communication that I have in interacting with somebody is how I am, not what I say. Not what I think, not what I say, but how I am. And if I am not rooted, I mean really rooted in a disciplined practice, then the nature of my suffering can quickly grab a hold of my mind, and I can wrap, because I'm wrapped up in this cloak of holiness, I can begin to excuse and justify the most abhorrent of behavior. I have a student. I don't have many students because I'm intensely selective about this process. But I do have a student who is a lieutenant colonel in the Chilean Army Air Force. He's a helicopter pilot. Now, I don't spend any time with him on the base. And I'm permitted not more than 3 days on the base. So I've been to visit his base. But very interesting is that he teaches flying. And he had a female student, the first female student in the Chilean Army to fly. And she was all anxious before her solo flight. And what he did is he brought her, sat her down in front of the helicopter, and they did Zazen before she did her solo flight. He doesn't eat any meat, fish, or poultry, doesn't drink any alcohol, doesn't take any tobacco products. And he's in the military. And he takes a lot of ridicule. But it's not my job to tell him being in the military is a correct or incorrect thing to do. You know, it's for me to be very clear with where I am. And there was a conflict for me whether to take him as a student or not. It was a conflict for me. But then I meet him in his humanity. He asked me, should I stay in the military or not? I said, it's not my decision. Just as long as you know these are the tenets. And how do you work with them? I'd like to meet your brother. What rank is he?
I think he's up to captain now.
How
old is he?
He's 50.
He's having a hard time in the military. But he's only a captain. No, I'm serious. No way, hang on.
No, it's in the Navy.
But he's having a hard time. Hmm. He's 50. So this is always about keeping these things into consideration. Though I know I have an insight into these things, having been in the military, and knowing what sort of the progressions are, having a sense of that. I was invited to do a talk with a group of 250 soldiers who just completed their basic training in Switzerland. I gave a talk to all of the officers that trained these people. The commander took me on a tour of the base. They brought me into the armory. And they were very proud. The commander was very proud. This is his life, you know. He's very proud. He pulls a weapon out of the armory. He was showing off the weapon because it's Swiss made. He was very proud about all that. And he had to hand me the weapon. Yeah, I'm a weapons expert. It's my training. And every fiber in my body wanted to take that weapon. And I wanted to hold the stock up to my shoulder. And I wanted to lay my cheek against it. I wanted to just caress this thing. I wanted to look down the sight. And level it at something. I feel the power of all that again. Because it's a powerful experience. If you haven't done it, you don't know. And what I did, instead of taking the weapon, it's practice. Place my hands in gosho. this position has saved my life. Place my hands in Gosho, bow to him in gratitude, and say, not this time. And walk out. In the talk, when people, I always have people introduce myself, and he said, my name is Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so, and I'm the commander here. And I said, not tonight. I'm the commander here tonight, you know. And bring these essential teachings, expose people to these essential teachings who've never been exposed to them before. But I do it because I'm invited. And they know. They know who I am and what I stand for before I enter into the room. I sit in front of these 250 young soldiers and say, the person that you were when you came here is not the person who leaves here. And they have no awareness of that. They still don't understand what I'm saying, but they've heard it now. And then I can articulate that. So, I'd love to meet your brother. You know, we'd have some... if he could talk to me. He might have too many ideas about who I am and what I stand for to be able to talk to me. I don't know, no one knows. Question? Yes, in the back.
Jerry.
What is it?
Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
What's the significance of the bell?
Wait a minute, do it again?
That's six words.
Yeah.
What's the significance of the bell?
See, you can do it in six words. Right on. Yeah.
What do you think?
A lot of things. It could be bringing attention to something. It could be letting something dissolve away and letting go. There's many things it could be.
What do you think, though?
I think that it's subjective, and what it would be for me is not the experience of what it is for you.
I didn't hear all that.
She said it would be subjective, so what it's for her wouldn't be what it is for us.
How do you know?
I don't.
So... what's it mean to you?
To me, in this moment where I am, it's letting go and letting it all fade away.
Okay. Then that's what it means for you. Mm-hmm. What's it? What's its function for Kenshin?
I want to say like, so I don't fall asleep.
That's one thing.
No, it is. You know, it is interesting for most people, they do understand with the sound of the bell that it is about paying attention. And so the bell is meant to communicate, in many ways, Buddha's voice, telling us to be here now, because by listening, we will have the tendency to drift off, you know, into our own world. I mean, we are in our own world anyway, but just for that moment, with the sound, just to connect with your breath and just practice being here and now, and not too much in our heads. And at the same time, it also communicates time. So it's a clock. It's purely by time when I invite the bell and help it to sing, so this way I can communicate with Thich Nhat Hanh the passing of time, and he can structure the evening in accordance. So I don't have to pull at him and go, hey, it's time to end. So we use this bell in all the events like this, but I'm not doing this the whole day like this. So it's to find these reminders like this bell in our daily life that can support us. We call them bells of mindfulness. This is a concrete bell, although some would argue if it's a bell. And then there are the other bells, sounds like this, or sights, or even emotions could be those bells of mindfulness. But thank you for asking, because since I have been in the Bay Area, no one has asked the question.
You're the first one. Yes. And questions like this are usually the most important, because they're the most obvious. But any last questions? In the back. Okay, two.
Santi Deva.
What is it?
Santi Deva.
Okay.
In six words, what's the most important teaching?
What's the most important
teaching?
There's suffering. Causes of suffering. And where there's a cause, there's a cure. And then there's the cure. Question?
I don't think I can do it in six words, but my dad likes to go hunting, and I don't know what I could do about that, if anything.
If anything,
yeah. What you can do about this, if anything.
Do you hunt? Then you're doing something. It's not. My father was a soldier in the Second War. He was in the Navy. My father was a school teacher, and he was voted Pennsylvania State Teacher of the Year. He was president of the Pennsylvania State Teachers Association. He was on the town council. He was a volunteer firefighter. He was on the emergency truck. He was doing all the right stuff. My father smoked 50 cigarettes a day, drank alcoholically, and was dead by the time he was 53. He never once spoke about his suffering. I was able to sing the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps hymns by the time I was 5. I knew them by heart. I was firing a weapon by the time I was 6. And by the time I was 8, I was already drunk for the first time. Actually, before that. And all of this was passed on to me from my mother and my father and from those generations before them. I can't bring my father back to life. I can't change the person who he is, but I can heal my father in me. And this is what I need. I need to not focus on my father and my mother. I mean, I did that. I focused on them and the government, and I focused on all these externals for years. And it just kept me trapped in these repeating cycles. What I can pay attention to and what I can do something about is I can wake up to the father in me, the mother in me. I can wake up to the government in me. And I can heal. I can heal by not rejecting or being controlled by that, but living in a conscious relationship with that so that I can choose differently. Time to end. I want to end in a rather usual way for me. First I'm going to take off the microphone. It might pop.
It's just this that pops.
Okay. Great. And in a usual way, I have to say that since my service in Vietnam, or as a result of my service in Vietnam, I have a very difficult time with first names, or with names. Hanging on to them. I have to make a real effort. Because, in truth, I didn't want to know who you were. Because when you got injured or killed, I didn't want to be that close to you. You just needed to do your job, and I could identify you by your name tag on your shirt. I didn't have to think about it. That's hung with me, and so I have a difficult time with names. And I'm doing this to set myself up here because I forgot both your names. But for the possibility to meet the community here, and for the invitation to come to the place, and your commitment to hold this place. I bow to you in deepest gratitude. To Kenshin. I'm not used to being in such tight spaces. Well, that's not true. To Kenshin for creating the space that has held us in this period of listening and speaking meditation with this Song of the Bell. And for her commitment to wake up, for her willingness to live differently, and for all of the support that she provides, not only to me, but the people we come in contact with, I bow to her in gratitude. And then all of you who are already enlightened, thought that was somebody's leg. I'm glad it wasn't. I'm going, oh man. For all of you who are already enlightened, and you are already enlightened, what prevents us from living our enlightened natures, of course, our suffering, our conditioning. I bow to you, all Buddhas to be. And I will say to you, I wear robes as a symbol of my commitment to serve Lord Buddha, which it means to serve you, each and every one of you. Because all of this is not other than Buddha. So if there's anything that I can do to support you on your path, please do not hesitate to ask me. Or hesitate, ask me anyway. I just have a favor to ask. If you wake up before me, please help me on my way.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.